Good morning. My name is Stanley Campbell, and I'm here speaking on behalf of Mr. Fields. In summary, Mr. Fields' argument is that there was nothing either in the 9/11 call or in anything that the officers saw as they were approaching his car in the alleyway that provided a reasonable suspicion to the officers.
Do you think the officers needed even that to walk up to the car and say, we'd like to talk to you for a minute?
If that's what they had done, the answer would be no.
Well, but let's just break this down. I mean, the first thing they do, of course they're called. We know that's why they wind up in the alley. But they're, I guess it's Officer Drummer in particular, is walking down the alley, and there's this car parked, and he walks up to the car. Right? Why does he need reasonable suspicion to do that?
If it were a consensual encounter, he would not. But our
answer. So why does he need reasonable suspicion at the moment he just walks up to the car?
As he's walking up to the car, it may not have been an investigative detention at that point.
No, it wasn't. He's walking up to the car. I mean, you know, somebody. When I drove into the garage this morning, one of the guards said, oh, by the way, you know, they're doing something at the bottom of the stairs with the door. I mean, he didn't need reasonable suspicion to ask me to roll my window down so I could hear him.
That would be correct.
The officer did walk up with his shotgun in the low ready position,
right.
Correct?
Right. And actually, there were two officers with shotguns, a third officer who was in a car shining a light upon Mr. Fields. And as the officers acknowledged during the suppression hearing, Mr. Fields was not free to leave at that point in time. He was clearly being detained by the police officers once they were at his vehicle.
Well, they walk up to the vehicle, as I say. If the walking up to the vehicle, I guess there are two possibilities here. One possibility is they don't need reasonable suspicion at that point, although maybe by the time they get there and he sees the gun, maybe you shift over to Terry. But if you can get them at the vehicle, then, of course, the next question is when the officer walks around the vehicle and sees the gun in plain view and the district court credits that account of the facts, it seems like everything else flows from there.
I would agree with you that our best argument is at the point where the police officers have arrived at the vehicle and have detained Mr. Fields. After that point in time, Mr. Fields doesn't have very good odds in terms of being successful in any kind of argument.
But what information did the police officers have that his possession of a firearm in the car was illegal?
I don't think they had any. The information they had was from a lady who called in and said she had seen a number of people in an alleyway, and when questioned by the dispatcher, she said that she thought they were long rifles or long guns, not firearms.
But she said a big gun.
A big gun.
She was asked whether they were long rifles, and she just said big.
Yeah.
But now, under Indiana law, it's, if you've got a permit, it's perfectly okay to have a gun in your vehicle, correct?
Handgun?
A handgun,
yes.
And as I understand it, that's treated as an affirmative defense. The permit is an affirmative defense to the crime of unlawful carrying. But do the police have a right simply to demand a permit at any time?
If a person has a handgun, can the police ask them if they have a permit for it?
Yes.
Yes, I would think so.
Okay, and he had said in this case he didn't have a gun.
He did.
Okay. They find the gun, then they put him on the ground, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And I think those are the facts we have to go with. He testified that.
Forget about his testimony.
Yeah.
What was he put on the ground for?
The police officers, I think from their point of view, would have said, well, he had indicated he didn't have a gun. They found a gun. They put him on the ground, I suspect, for safety's purposes, to determine whether or not They had someone who had a permit for a gun, plus they had the report from the lady that she had seen guns in the
alley. I haven't met her any more guns, if he's going to lie about one.
But that would be their argument. Yeah, I don't necessarily
agree
with that.
For their argument.
And getting back to the point Judge Wood was making, when I think it's Drummer proceeds toward the Ford Explorer, it's backed up to a building. Are you? And he claims it was parked illegally. Are you contesting that it was illegally parked there at that spot?
I won't quarrel that his vehicle may have been over the yellow lines or the white lines that designated where you're going to park a car, but my guess would be that if you walked around in the parking garages around this building and were going to detain and search people and vehicles who were parked with their tires across, it would be a long job for the police officers.
And it's late at night, right? So
it's not terribly. It's like 9:15, and mm-hmm. at my age, that's my bedtime. But at 9:15, I don't think the state or the government can say, well, there's something suspicious about the time of the evening, because there are residential apartment units that are along that alleyway there. So,
Mr. Campbell, in some of our previous cases that deal with these 911 calls. The person calls in, there's a fight going on, there's a disturbance going on, some kind of ongoing emergency. We don't have that language here, but does the outcome of this case, from your perspective, depend on the precise language that the caller used?
I think it's significant in that the question, I think, is whether or not the call is one in which the caller is simply describing perhaps some sort of general activity that may be gone, that may be criminal, or is specifically describing an emergency situation. And I know the government quarreled with our raising the issue, and we're not questioning the reliability of the phone call or the content of the phone call. What we are questioning is how you characterize that phone call. That's exactly our point.
You've been talking about the phone call, and the district court understood you were talking about the phone call all along, I think. So I'm not concerned about that.
Okay.
If you'd like to save a little rebuttal time, that's fine. Okay. Ms. Nomei?
May it please the Court, Tina Nomei for the United States of America. It's the government's position in this case that the district court committed no error when it denied the motion to suppress filed by Mr. Fields.
But I have a very broad question for you, Ms. Nomei, which has to do with a lot of these gun cases. As I'm sure you're aware, as we speak, the Supreme Court is hearing arguments in McDonald versus City of Chicago, and that case has the potential of really changing the validity of any inference that somebody's behaving illegally if they're carrying a gun around. I don't, of course, have any crystal ball. I don't know what the court is going to say in that case, but thinking of Heller, thinking of McDonald, For somebody like this 911 caller to call and say, I see a bunch of guys, they're out in the alley, and one of them has a gun, you might be saying, you know, one of them's holding an umbrella. I mean, is it something that really leads rationally to the assumption that there's illegal activity afoot?
I think so. When you consider our community and the fact that, I know this wasn't part of the record because we didn't develop it, but there's shootings going on in Fort Wayne all the time. We've
that
got
may
drugs
be,
on the
but
street.
Would the Supreme Court's Heller and Heller decision, it seems to me one of the things Justice Scalia is saying in that opinion is people have guns. A lot of people have guns. Some people who shouldn't have them maybe have them. Many people who are perfectly law-abiding citizens who want their guns for whatever reason they may want them, for self-protection, for hunting, for whatever they might use guns for, have them. So how do you know?
But in this case, it wasn't an individual who just happened to be kind of like the Florida versus JL situation, an individual who's at a bus stop who happens to have a gun on him, and someone calls in and tells them that it was an anonymous tip and this person has a gun. In this case, we have a 911 call that gives particular information about a group of individuals in an alleyway at night, parked by a business that's closed, and some activities going on. She's scared. She's fearful. I mean, we want our citizens...
Take it apart. What in that report that you just rehearsed suggests illegality?
Well, what we come to learn later was a brick was thrown through the...
We don't know that, though. We have to look at it from the ex-ante point of view, and it's not unlawful for people to gather in an alley. It's not unlawful, perhaps, we'll see, you know, I'm not sure the niceties of the Indiana gun laws, but the Supreme Court may turn all of this inside out anyway. What's unlawful? What justifies the police coming and throwing people on the ground and so on?
It's not necessarily unlawful, because even under Terry, innocent behavior can be something that the police look at. So I think it's the concern and the education that we've given to individuals that if you see something going on in your community that you think is suspicious, that you are fearful about, and you want to call police to investigate.
Yes, and it's perfectly okay, and we want the police to respond to those calls and to walk and talk or knock and talk. But okay, they approached with guns at the ready.
Well, because they got the call that there are individuals involved with guns, so they're prepared.
They're cautious. But let's see. The way to frame this, I guess, is in the district court's opinion. I'm looking at page 6. Judge Springman is describing Drummer's look at the Explorer. When he looked through the small passenger side back window, he saw the hand grip and back part of a handgun, etc. Officer Drummer alerted the other officers about the gun, and they told the defendant to get on the ground and placed him in handcuffs. What for?
Well, at that point, they believed, before that point, based on the conversation they had had with Mr. Fields, they knew that he might be they believed him to be involved in the activity that was the basis of the 911 call.
Without any specific indication of criminal activity.
Yes. At this point, though, they see the gun, and they've already asked him, do you have a gun? He says no. And they go off their theory. I believe they testified at the suppression hearing that where there's one gun, there's always more. It's based on their experience as police officers. The individual was nervous. He lied about the fact that he didn't have a gun. And in plain view, when they walk around, they see a gun. So for officer safety, they have him get down to the ground. They do a records check, find out that he has no permit.
Okay, well, after they do the records check, obviously everything is okay.
Right.
The question is what happens up to the...
Your best evidence is the lie, I think. I think mm-hmm. it's very thin up until the moment that he lies and they spot the gun in plain view.
And the officers testified at the suppression hearing that they approached the vehicle. I mean, it's the only vehicle there. They ask him questions. They say, this is why we're here. We got a call, a 911 call about individuals in the alleyway. And the guy says, well, me and my friends were here, and they just left. So he's kind of putting himself in that group. They don't know exactly what's going on.
Some people have just left. So, I mean, at that point, what he's saying is consistent with their observations.
And somebody else is pulling over that vehicle, and they're not finding a weapon in that vehicle.
He's telling the truth at that point. You know, I was here with my friend. Somebody just left. The officer should think, yeah, we just saw a car pulling out. Okay, so far,
and
so good.
And if he had just said, no, I had no weapon, and they didn't see anything visible, they said they would have let him go. At that point, it's their job as police officers to investigate that scene. Had they let him go and he had a gun and someone got shot, then there's a liability aspect they have to deal with. So they did their investigation, and I think things progress based on Mr. Fields' conduct and the circumstances and the statements that he made, and that's why the case went where it did in terms of him then being arrested and us finding the crack. But certainly the police officers were not free to ignore the call. I understand that this is an issue. People have the right to bear arms. The problem is when you have individuals calling for 911 about an emergency, a circumstance, something that scares them, we're not free to ignore that. And I think it is the nature of guns and the nature of the fact that we do have people killed almost every weekend in Fort Wayne, shooting in guns. We've got illegal gun sales going on, straw purchases going on. I don't know the way to solve it. I don't know what the answer is, but the problem is we have too many guns on the streets.
Ms. Nome, was there anything in this record indicating that this was a particularly dangerous spot or a high crime area. That's a factor that's been relevant in some of the court's previous cases like this.
We didn't get into that, Your Honor. In this case, we stuck mainly to the facts and the circumstances that they progressed. Okay. But as a resident of Fort Wayne and having lived there most of my life and reading the newspaper every weekend and week as I do, it's a tragedy to see the shootings.
We also know that there were residences in this area.
There were. The residents are on the other side of the alley, and where Mr. Fields was parked was right by a business, Lutheran Social Services. It was 9 o'clock at night. It was a cold, dark alley, and it was closed. He was the lone vehicle sitting there with his lights on, engine running. And the officers didn't park him in when they approached him, but they did approach him and turn the light on so that they could let him see that they are police officers as well, because you don't want to come up on a car where you think an individual's got a gun and then risk the fact that you could be shot. But they didn't point the guns at Mr. Fields. Only two of them were armed, and of course Mr. Fields gave quite a different story to the district court, and she chose not to believe him and found him to be not credible.
And of course, Ms. Nome, you understand when we're trying to understand the total circumstances of this, not just the particulars of what their activity is, that the surrounding neighborhood, the issues in the neighborhood can become very relevant. So just, you know, in terms of the future and looking to, I mean, these are factors that make a difference to the court.
And I think in the future I'll make sure we talk about the fact that it was the south side of town and it is a bad area.
We can't take into account any of those statements you've made.
I understand that. It's not
in this determination.
Right. It's not part of the record. I understand that. You have any other questions? I do think that there is an aspect of waiver here in terms of the argument that was the challenge to the reliability of the 911 call, because the district court specifically said you may be challenging whether or not anything you did was suspicious, but you didn't challenge the reliability of the 911 call or the fact that it created reasonable suspicion. And she made that finding. Mr. Fields never raised the Florida analysis, in his brief cited to Hicks or cited to any of the Seventh Circuit cases dealing with 911 calls and their reliability. So I think he is precluded from that. I used the Kirkland case as a forfeiture it speaks in terms of forfeiture, although I think the case really dealt with waiver. But I think there's two factors to consider, and I think that the defendant has waived his ability to challenge the reliability of that 911 call. Thank you.
Okay. Anything further, Mr. Campbell?
A couple of calls. And one is that Mr. Fields' statement that he didn't have a gun only becomes a lie, of course, after the fact. And to say it was a lie.
Well, I don't know about that. He says, I don't have a gun, and the gun is sitting there in the car. It was a lie when he made it. They figured it out after the fact, but it was a lie when he said it.
Well, but at the time, the statement to the police officers, it could have been interpreted as a lie, but it also could have been, without further questioning of Mr. Fields, the officers would have had no way of knowing whether it was a lie or not.
But that's why plain view is important. They're entitled to walk around the car and peek in. They can't open it up and shuffle it or anything, but they see the gun in plain view.
And that's correct. And it seems to me that this working backward in a lot of these suppression hearings is what police officers do. Experience becomes a catch-all phrase for whatever they see or observe. Insofar as the defendant is concerned, he was looking away from me. That's suspicious in my experience. He was looking right at me. That's suspicious in my experience. In many of these cases, what a person does or doesn't do in and of itself somehow becomes suspicious and a basis for police officers doing things. The other thing I want to say, and just from a personal point of view, and that is, I understand we fight wars. We're fighting wars against drugs, and we're fighting against violence in our cities, but I don't think that's a reason to abdicate or to empower the police to make decisions for us in terms of what's going to happen out there out on the streets. So, thank you.
All right. Thank you. And you were appointed, were you not? We appreciate your service to your client and to the court. Thank you as well.